I'm going to get John to come and bring the reading to us. It's from Deuteronomy, chapter 15.
Every seventh year you shall grant a remission of debts. And this is the manner of the remission. Every creditor shall remit the claim that is held against a neighbour, not exacting it of a neighbour who is a member of the community, because the Lord's remission has been proclaimed. Of a foreigner you may exact it. But you must remit your claim on whatever any member of your community owes you. There will, however, be no one in need among you, because the Lord is sure to bless you in the land that the Lord your God is giving you as a possession to occupy. If only you will obey the Lord your God by diligently observing this entire commandment that I command you today. When the Lord your God has blessed you, as he promised you, you will lend to many nations, but you will not borrow. You will rule over many nations, but they will not rule over you. If there is among you anyone in need, a member of your community, in any of the towns within the land that the Lord is giving you, do not be hard-hearted or tight-fisted towards your needy neighbour. You should rather open your hand, willingly lending enough to meet that need, whatever it may be. Be careful that you do not entertain a mean thought, thinking, the seventh year, the year of remission, is near, and therefore view your needy neighbour with hostility and give nothing. Your neighbour might cry to the Lord against you, and you would incur guilt. Give liberally and be ungrudging when you do so, for on this account the Lord your God will bless you in all your work and in all that you undertake. Since there will never cease to be some in need on the earth, I therefore command you, open your hand to the poor and needy neighbour in the land. If a member of your community, whether a Hebrew man or a Hebrew woman, is sold to you and works for you for 6 years, in the seventh year you shall set that person free. And when you send a male slave out from you, a free person, you shall not send him out empty-handed. Provide liberally out of the flock, your threshing floor and your winepress, thus giving to him some of the bounty for which the Lord your God has blessed you. Remember that you were a slave in the land of Egypt, and the Lord your God redeemed you. For this reason I lay this command upon you today. But if he says to you, I will not go from you, because he loves you and your household, since he is well off with you, then you shall take an owl and thrust it through his earlobe into the door, and he shall be your slave forever. You shall do the same with regard to your female slave. Do not consider it a hardship when you send them out from you, free persons, because the 6 years that they have given you service, worth of wages of a hired labour, and the Lord your God will bless you in all that you do. Every firstling, male born of your herd and flock, you shall consecrate to the Lord your God. You shall not do work with your firstling ox, nor shear the firstling of your flock. You shall eat it, you together with your household, in the presence of the Lord your God, year by year at the place that the Lord has chosen. But if it has any defect, any serious defect such as lameness or blindness, you shall not sacrifice it to the Lord your God. Within your towns you may eat it, the unclean and the clean alike, as you would a gazelle or a deer. Its blood, however, you must not eat. You shall pour it out on the ground like water.
What God is doing here, and you can see it, you can tell by the end of chapter 15, what Moses is still doing, we're still talking about this invitation to come and eat at this, at the Lord's table. And what we did last time, I think it was, you pointed out that the old practices in Canaan and the old practices across all of the Middle East, the world, as it's known at that time, was for people to bring sacrifices and give them to God. And that was, they're just lost, they're burnt up and consumed, whether it's food, whether it's wine, whether it's money, whether it was your children. Just brought them along and destroyed them, handed over to God. But God said, in my land, the worship of me is going to be very different. It's very different. This whole system, that's not what I'm about. But basically, instead of bringing all these sacrifices and just destroying them before me, what I'm going to do is you bring them, you sacrifice them to me, and then I'm going to give you them back. And what's going to happen is you're going to come and sit and eat the food of the gods in my presence and rejoice. It's a festival. It's a tenth of all that you produce in a year. You're going to come and you're going to eat in these 5 days of a feast, a month's worth of food and luxury, a month's worth of wine you're going to consume in this week of a celebration. It sounds bigger than Christmas. I do my best to eat a month's worth of food at Christmas. So, but it's bigger than that. There's a little caveat, because what you're supposed to do is, you're supposed to bring it along and share it with the priests, so they get a little bit, and you're supposed to bring it along, we're here, and we see in this passage, and share it with the poor, and those who can't afford to bring things. Everybody, the stranger, and the foreigner in the land, they're going to come and share in God's bounty as well. It's a massive feast in celebration of all the bounty that God is ready to pour out on you. It's there in verse 29 of chapter 14. It was made clear at the start of this section, chapter 12 and verse 22. Make sure you bring in those widows and the orphans and the foreigner to share this feast. And so what happens now in chapter 15, we get to the thorny issue. What about the poor? What should happen to them? And I say it's a thorny issue because in our passage, what Moses says there in verse 4, there shouldn't be any poor. Nobody should be poor. Carol's smirking, which is right to smirk. There shouldn't be any in this land. Because God's bringing into a land flowing with milk and honey, his desire is to pour blessing upon blessing out of you. Everyone should share in this bounty. There's everything there for the taking, all the blessings and richness of God. And so when you come to this land and you come to the Lord's table, nobody should be poor. There shouldn't be anybody. At the end of verse 4, what it says is that God will richly bless you. Verse 5 and 6, if you obey. There's a condition. If you obey, God will do just what he's promised. What's going to happen with the nation of Israel if you obey is that you will be so rich that you've got more than you could ever need. And in fact, as a nation, what's going to happen to you as a nation, all of the other nations round about, they're going to come to you. And you're going to lend to them. You'll never have to borrow from another nation. You'll never be destitute. They'll all come to you. You were slaves and you were servants in Egypt, but you will never be slaves again. You've been set free. No one will rule over you. That's what it should be like if you obey. So how do we think that went? Not well. Not well. The Israelites did not obey, and so this utopia never happened. When Jesus came, he said, the poor, you will always have among you. Here in verse 4, our passage, it says, there shouldn't be any poor. Jesus says, you will always have poor. Do you know where Jesus is quoting from? He's quoting from our passage, verse 7. Verse 7. If there is a poor man amongst you, and then just a little bit later, there will always be poor in the land, Moses says. And he knows it. Moses knows it because he's not naive. Israel just would not put their part of the covenant into practice. Jesus quotes the passage, and in the story, and it's in the Gospels, if you wanted to find it, it's Matthew 26, or Mark 14, John 12, any of those you could look at. What actually happens in that situation is there's a lady that's come into Jesus' presence, and she has an alabaster jar, like a ceramic vase full of perfume, and what she does is she breaks it and washes Jesus' feet with it. It's really expensive perfume. The perfume filled the whole house that it told. And what happened is, some of the disciples, they were grumbling. And they're saying, oh, what a waste. What a waste. This should have been sold, and it should have been given to the poor. That's what should have happened, they've said. But that's hypocrisy, because they just didn't do it. In fact, these great gifts to the poor, these magnificent displays, they were just displays. They were just pious displays. There were exceptions to the rule. They were not normal practice. So if we think about what I mean by that, we think about the story of the rich young ruler. So this is in Matthew 19. What happened is, there's a ruler in Israel. It's got lots of wealth. It's doing really well. And he comes to Jesus and he says, you know, what do I need to do to inherit eternal life? And Jesus says to him, well, you just keep the commandments. And he says, yeah, I've done all these ever since I was a little boy. And as Jesus looked on him, he looked at him and he said, there's one thing that you lack. There's one thing that you lack. You're a rich man. He didn't say these words, but this is summarizing the story. You're a rich man, but what I can see is that this wealth has a hold on you. That's what's holding you back. God says, pour out your wealth and he's going to bless you. So Jesus says, sell everything you have, give it to the poor, and come and follow me. That's what he says to him. And he couldn't do it. He couldn't trust God. Or he didn't see the walk with Jesus as being worth it. Giving away all of this wealth to the poor. I think another example is when Paul is writing to the Corinthians. And he's giving some extreme examples. And he says, this is 1 Corinthians 13 verse 3. He says, if I do this really extreme thing, but haven't love, then this is not worthwhile. And the extreme thing he says, if I give all I possess to the poor, but I don't have love, it's worth nothing. It's worth nothing. And so what we can see is this idea of giving these great gifts, it's seen as a great pious act, but it just wasn't happening. It wasn't normal practice. It was like something exceptional. And so we think about a passage, and I'm going to ask the question, what's supposed to happen? When you go back to Exodus 21, Exodus 23, and Leviticus 25, these are all places where the law is given out. And what happens is in those places, all the rules are laid out for a Sabbath year. So Sabbath year is every seventh year, special things are supposed to happen. You call this time the Lord's time for cancelling debts, and that's what Moses is talking about in our passage. The Lord's time for cancelling debts. And what's supposed to happen then is the fields are supposed to be given a break. You'll plough your fields and put seeds in and harvest them for 6 years, but on the seventh year, then you're supposed to just leave them fallow. You don't plant them, you don't work them, you just give them a break. You can go and gather what's grown naturally, all the leftover seed from the year before, but give the fields a break. And what you also do in that year is you give the debtors a break. Those that owe money to you, you give them a break. What happens is those have become so poor and destitute that they've signed over their lives to you. They become effectively your slaves. Indentured servants is the right phrase, but they become your slaves. You need to give them a break in the seventh year. That's what the rules are. And so what Moses is doing here, in verse 2 he says, this, when we go into this new land now, as we're about to go into it, this is how we're going to put those laws into practice. This is what we're going to do. This is how it's to be done. This is the manner. This is the form that it's going to be done in. What we're going to do, verse 2, cancel any loans. Verse 3, cancel all debts. And verse 13 and 14, send away those slaves, those indentured servants. Send them away with money in their pockets and liberal quantities of food and wine and livestock. That's what's going to happen every 7 years. Now, the natural human reaction is not to do that. We want to keep it for ourselves. We want to keep it for ourselves. And hence Moses, he sees this attitude. He's not naive. So in verse 11, what he says is, you know, this is what I want. I want you to have this heart that's generous and giving, a heart that trusts in God to provide for you and bless for you, if you'll only open your hands to others. And he says, this is what I want to change in your heart. I want to change in your heart. But he's realistic. And so what he does in verse 11, he says, I command you to be open-handed. I command you to be generous. And he says, the reason is like almost endearing them now. He says in the next verse, I paraphrase it, I want you to be open-handed to the poor and needy because they're your family. They're your brothers. They're your sisters. I want you to be open-handed and I want you to be generous. But Moses can hear the reaction of the people as they're reminded of these laws that they should have been keeping, but obviously were not keeping. So as they're reminded of them, he can hear their arguments. And so his argument here is, what happens if we're in year 6.5? You know, there's only 6 months left. And I give this great loan to this person because they need it, or I take them into service. What's going to happen? Because in 6 months, they're never going to repay the debt. I'm never going to get my money back. You know, and it's bad enough that I'm going to lose all the revenue from this field, that I've got to leave fallow for a year. I'm not going to get anything really from that. So it's not right. And Moses says, no, guard yourself against that. If you are generous, verse 10, if you are generous and you open up your hands, if you do this, God will bless you. In fact, Leviticus 25 tells us that God would actually bless them in advance. Because if you're thinking, how do we cope with that? We've got these fields, you know, we're living as subsistence farmers, as we might imagine it should be. We've got 7 years, 6 years I can work it, but I've got a whole year where things go pear-shaped because I'm not going to get the harvest out of it that I really need. And where am I going to get my seed for the next year from? Because if I can't plant it and I can't harvest it, then I've lost 2 years. And I'm in a terrible state. Leviticus 25, 21, God says, I will send you such blessing in the sixth year, the land will yield enough for 3 years. Remember in the wilderness when they were collecting the manna, they had 6 days, and the seventh day they weren't allowed to collect anything. If they did, it just spoiled. Would have thought they'd learned the lesson. But what happened was God graciously, on the sixth day, gave them twice as much. And if they kept what was extra on that sixth day, then they'd have enough for the Sabbath, and then they'd go out and yield again. You would have thought they'd learned the lessons. But God's even more generous. I'm going to give you 3 years. You can have plenty. Absolutely plenty. And so you would have thought, well, actually, we're better off because we get an extra year of harvest if we obey God, if you do your maths properly. And so the Israelites should have been really well off and doing really well, but it just didn't happen. People just were not willing to be generous. They weren't even willing, you know, to respect the Sabbath years, never mind be generous to the poor. There's two occasions in the Old Testament, two occasions that we read of where they've actually put some of this Sabbath year ideas into practice, you know, so leaving the fields fallow and setting the slaves free. So the first one is in Jeremiah 34, and this is just before the Israelites were sent away to Babylon. What happened was that Israel had just fallen into such sin and degradation, and God warned them time and time again through more and more prophets that if they didn't sort themselves out, they were going to be driven to the land. They were going to be driven to Babylon, which we're now looking at with Daniel. That's exactly why Daniel's there, because he got to this point. Well, this is just before that, a little while before that. There's like a little reprieve in all this evilness. Jeremiah 34, what happens is King Zedekiah, he succeeds briefly in securing a release for slaves under this law. Jeremiah 34:11 says, after King Zedekiah had done this, and forced the people by a command to do this, it says in verse 11 of Jeremiah 34, but afterwards the people changed their minds, backed the slaves they had freed, and enslaved them again. So then, having been driven away into exile, and the horrendous things that happened to Daniel, despite the blessing there, but when they eventually come back with Ezra, you can read the stories in Ezra and Nehemiah. And what they do is they come back and they rededicate themselves to God. And in chapter 10 of Nehemiah, verse 31, what we find is specifically in this covenant that they re-establish, and what they'll do is they reinstate the Sabbath year and the cancelling of the debts. So they brought this back in. That's in chapter, at the end of chapter 10. In chapter 13, just two passages later, what happens is that the Ezra records, because he's writing there in Nehemiah, he records that these practices, the Sabbath year release, has been abandoned. They're just not following it anymore. So those two points in time, they weren't doing it, and then somebody tries to force it in, but it doesn't even look as though they managed to keep up a full 7 year cycle. It seems as though they got to six and then just got all the plenty and just didn't bother continuing, didn't set the slaves free. In fact, what we're told is they didn't even bother to give any of their tithes to God. Even though the tithe wasn't really given, even though the idea was within their own tongues or at the temple, they would go and they would eat it themselves. It was a feast and a celebration, but they weren't even willing to do that. They weren't willing to celebrate God's presence. They weren't willing to share what they've got with others. Malachi 3:8, what God says about this is he says, "You rob me. You rob me. Test me in this," he says. "Bring the whole tithe in and see if I will not throw open the floodgates of heaven and pour out so much blessing, you'll not have room enough for it." do what I've asked you to do. Bring it in. The people didn't want to. They worked hard for it. They want to keep it. They don't want to share it. That's what our human nature is like. And so you could look and you could ask the question and you say, well, no, why did God put in place such unreasonable laws that somebody who can't manage their own debt and have gotten themselves into such a state where they've sold themselves to you and because they're in debt and they owe you money, you take them on and then 6 months later you've just got to let them go free. And not only that, you're going to give them sheep and you're going to give them food and you're going to give them the land back and you're going to give them wine and send them on the way. How can God ask that? Verse 15 of a passage. He tells us, remember that you were slaves in Egypt and the Lord your God redeemed you. That's why I'm giving you this command today. That's because that's what I'm like as God. I pour blessings and I've set you free. I've given you blessings. Respond. This is what my land, this is what my people should be like. As we look at this passage, I say in that bigger context, this is this invitation to God's temple. That's what this tithes and stuff are all about. And this year of release and of bounty, we're about coming and sharing and meeting with God. And God says, you know, he wants that practice to be very different to what happened in the world at the time. Very different to what was happening in Canaan. But it's not just about this food and about the sacrificial and the worship system. What God wants is, he wants to be a completely different system of social justice. That's what he's wanting. What happened was, we've just been told there in verse 15, that Israel were rescued from Egypt where they were slaves. Where they, in fact, they were indentured servants, turned into slaves. Now think about how that happened. So this is looking back in your Bible. And at the end of Genesis, the last few chapters, probably from about Genesis 41 onwards up to about 47, you can read this story. If you remember what had happened is Joseph was sold by his brothers as a slave into Egypt. So Joseph was sold into Egypt. While he's there, the Pharaoh, the king of Egypt, the king of the empire, has a dream. And in this dream, it's a really perplexing dream, what he sees is seven fat cows coming out of the river. Huge, great, fat, glorious, healthy-looking cows. And then what happens is he then sees seven of their skinniest, scrawniest cows come out of the river. And they eat all the fat cows. And he can't work out this dream. And so Joseph is called in. And Joseph comes and explains this dream to them. What's going to happen, he says, there's going to be 7 years where there's going to be real plenty. There's going to be loads of food in the land. But what's going to happen is, after those 7 years, there's going to be 7 years of severe famine. So Pharaoh, you need to prepare for that. Pharaoh says, wise Joseph, you need to prepare for that. You're second in command in all the lines, all the land. So what's going to happen, Joseph, is you are in charge of collecting all the surplus grain from those 7 years and storing it, keeping it safe, so that we've got a good way of getting through these 7 years of famine. And so that's exactly what Joseph did, and he was very, very good at it, very fair in all of his dealings. But the practicality of what happened was that all across the known world, there was famine. In Israel, in Canaan, there was famine among his family. And what happened was they came across to Egypt because Egypt was the only place in the world where you could actually get food, you could get grains, the only place you could go to for it. And so they went to Egypt, but they had to buy it. They had to buy their food. And of course, when they get there, they find out Joseph's brothers, find out that Joseph is in charge, and Pharaoh finds out they're all related. And what he does is he gives to the Israelites the land of Goshen, which is the richest, most fertile land. It's in the middle of a famine, but they're managing to keep things going a little bit. So he gives the Israelites, really blesses them with this land. But nevertheless, the famine continues to take hold. And it affects Goshen. It stripped Canaan. And so what happens in Genesis 47, we're told that what happens is everybody across the world, in Canaan, in Egypt, the Israelites as well, first of all, they came and they sold all of their livestock to Pharaoh. So they'll sell you all of the livestock because then we can get the money to buy the grain that we need to eat. And Pharaoh will look after the cattle, but it's his now. And then when that money ran out, what they then did is they came back and they sold themselves and they sold their land to Pharaoh, as slaves to him, indebted to him. And that's what they did. And that's the way the world works. That's the way social order works. This is what you did. But in 400 years, the Israelites never got a reprieve. They were taken into slavery. The land had gone. The money had gone. Their livestock had gone. There was no escape. They were trapped in poverty forever. They couldn't get out and go back and repopulate their own land. It was covered by invaders, but their livestock had gone. What were they to do? They were just trapped there. But God redeemed them. God won their freedom from the land of Egypt. He said, I'm going to take you out of there and I'm going to put you back in the promised land. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to fill your pockets with all that you need. And the Egyptians, who the ordinary people who loved the Israelites, gave them gold and jewelry and stuff for the journey so that he had enough to get back to the promised land and give them a good start in life to escape the poverty and get to this land of milk and honey and plenty. And God plucked them out and sent them on their way. We say nothing of the fact, well, a little of the fact, that what did they do? They squandered their gold and jewelry. They gathered it all together and they cast it into a golden calf that they worshipped. They never go back, as Moses said, you will grind that calf into dust and put it in a bit of waters of Meribah and you're going to drink it. That's gone forever. What a waste of what they were given. The system that operated Egypt of getting themselves into debt and being trapped there forever without a miracle enabling them to escape, God wanted a very different system for his people. Once freed, his people should never be enslaved again. That's what that passage tells us. If they fell into difficulty, they should never be trapped in it again. God wasn't asking for them to do in the past. He wasn't asking them to do more than he had already done. God had and he was and providing all the blessings that they needed to be different. To be different to the rest of the world. But greed, selfishness, and lack of faith and trust in God ruined the lives of so many Israelites. And ultimately, as we're reading in Daniel, ultimately it resulted in captivity in Babylon. The brightest and the best of the sons of Israel taken away and made to serve in a foreign land, bound there. Moses knew it would happen. Verse 16 and 17, I've heard lots of sweet little sermons on these two verses in 16 and 17. But the reality is, I'll read it to you, the reality is, it's dreadful. Verse 16 and 17. Set your servants free, he says, after 6 years, set them free. Send them off with money in their pocket. But, verse 16, if your servant says to you, I don't want to leave you, because he loves you and your family and is well off with you, then take an awl, it's like a little nail and a piece of wood to make holes and pieces of wood, take an awl and push it through his earlobe into the door and he will become your servant for life. Now there's a real irony there. I don't know whether you can spot it. There's a little bit of extra information I can give you. The Egyptian word for slave is listener. It's listener. And the Israelites' freedom from slavery was won on the night that the blood of the lamb was smeared on the doorposts of their houses. Exodus 12. But here they are in our chapter, verse 16 and 17. They would rather nail themselves by the ears as slaves again. They'd rather be nailed to the house's doorposts, preferring their own to shed their own sweat and blood rather than receiving the freedom that the blood of the Lamb bought them. Dreadful story. But that's what they would do. They chose bondage over freedom. They've been set free, no longer slaves, and they've tied themselves back into slavery again. As we get to the end of the passage now, near the end, end of chapter Deuteronomy 15, what we see there in verses 12 to 15 is Moses is re-emphasizing the fact that we're still on this topic of dining at the Lord's table. He brings that back into us because we should all be drawn in. It doesn't matter that this poor, it doesn't matter how foolish they are, it doesn't matter whether you think they've squandered their money, it doesn't matter whether you have this false idea that the reason they're poor is because they're disobedient and not obeying God, and so you can look down on them because they deserve it. They deserve what they get. can't despise them. You can't withhold your hand from them. Your brothers and your sisters, take them in and care for them at this table. And so, as I say, at the end of chapter 15, Moses reminds us that it's this feast of the first fruits. We're sharing at God's table together. But if you went back and you studied those passages, the Exodus 21 and 23 and Leviticus 25, if you went back and read those passages, what you'd realize is there's a big gaping hole here that Moses has left out. What about the year of Jubilee? What about the year of Jubilee? What's happened to that? It's not even mentioned in the book of Deuteronomy at all. It should be here, but it's not mentioned. What's the book of Jubilee? Oh, the year of Jubilee. Well, what's supposed to happen is we have this 7-year cycle where, you set the slaves free and release the debts. That's supposed to happen every 7 years. Well, that goes on for 7 lots of 7, 49 years. But then in the 50th year, what's supposed to happen is at the Day of Atonement, at the day when the nation's sins are absolved from, a great trumpet should sound throughout the whole of the land. The year of Jubilee has started and everyone is to be set free. All of the land, whether it's been bought or not, or taken in slavery and debt, everything is given back to the original families. Everybody returns to his own home. In fact, what God says, the reason for this, Leviticus 25:23, the land cannot be sold permanently. It must not be sold permanently because the land is mine. The land is God's. It's not yours. It's my land, Leviticus 25:23. In fact, if you actually turn to Galatians 3 and verse 16, what we actually find out there is specifically the land is Jesus' land, the seed of Abraham. It was his. It was always promised to him. The Israelites were allowed to live in it, but they couldn't keep hold of it permanently. So what happens is every 50 years, God has said, you give it back to the families I allotted it to. Now, if we think about the start of Deuteronomy, think about what this book is. The book of Deuteronomy, this is the legal contract between God and his people for the land. This is what the agreement is. You follow these rules and these laws and you will prosper and you will live well and you will do well in this new land that I'm giving you. This is what it is. This is what Deuteronomy is. It's this covenant, this contract between the people of Israel and God. And so, the year of Jubilee and the giving of the land back to the people, it should be here. It should be here. We might get a little bit confused. I got confused, certainly the start of it, confused in this 7-year cycle with the Jubilee cycle. But they're very different things. As I say, the 7-year sabbatical year was like a little pocket, a little taster of the great Jubilee that was to come. But in fact, as I say, there's no mention of it in this contract. There's no mention of it in Deuteronomy. In fact, the year of Jubilee, there's no mention of it anywhere in the Bible, of ever having been put into practice. And we can see why that is, because if they couldn't even manage the 7-year cycles, and in fact, if they couldn't manage the tithes and give their tithes back to God, then you can see there's no way that they're going to continue and do a proper Jubilee every 50 years. I think what this shows, maybe Moses was being realistic, they didn't bother to put it in here, didn't even bother to include it. The reason is because under this covenant between Israel and God, under the Deuteronomic covenant, this covenant of law, they would never receive the true freedom of Jubilee. They would never truly be set free from their slavery. They'd always choose to go back to the mire. They'd always choose to be nailed back against the doorposts. They'd always choose that. In fact, Isaiah 61 shows us that this whole idea of this great Jubilee, the 50th year Jubilee, where everyone is set free, it foreshadows an even more glorious Jubilee. At the start of Jesus' ministry, one of the very first things that he did is in Luke chapter 4. This is what he does. Luke 4 verses 16 to 21. He went to Nazareth, where he'd been brought up. And on the Sabbath day, he went into the synagogue, as was his custom, and he stood up to read. The scroll of the prophet Isaiah was handed to him. The scroll was rolled up, piece of paper, with the writings written on there, and it looks as though, typically, it was 7 meters long, 7 meter long scroll. Unrolling it, he found the place where it's written. It's chapter 61. It's the end of this scroll. Is unrolled 7 meters of it to the end of the scroll. And this is what he reads. The Spirit of the Lord is on me, because he had anointed me to preach good news to poor. He sent me to proclaim freedom for the prisoners, recovery of sight for the blind, to release the oppressed, to proclaim the year of the Lord's favour, the year of Jubilee. And then he rolled up the scroll, gave it back to the attendant, and sat down. And the eyes of everyone in the synagogue were fastened on him. And he said, today, this scripture is fulfilled in your hearing. It's the year of Jubilee. Now is the year of Jubilee. When Christ arrived, what had happened was, in the Garden of Eden, there's a tree planted, the tree of knowledge of good and evil. If you eat of it, you will die. We're told in Scripture, the wages of sin is death. If you want to go it alone, if you want to do your own thing, if you want to reject me as your God, you can do it, but it means death. It means eternal separation from me. It means a limited life. That's the price of you choosing to go against me. And sadly, that's the wages. That's the price that must be paid. That doesn't set us free. All that happens is if we die, we just get eternally cut off from him and separated from in captivity. Because that's the punishment. That's the due. That's the wages. But what Jesus did was he came and he paid the price of our redemption. All the punishment that was due to us, he took upon himself. His blood is smeared on the doorpost to set us free. We don't need to be nailed to that slavery any longer. He's promised us a new land, a new heaven, and a new earth. He's given us a deposit guaranteeing our inheritance. We shall inherit all the wealth of what he wants to give us. We go to a place where there's no famine, where there are trees that line the river that yield their fruit every month, every year, the whole time. There's no rest because the bounty of God is available to us. That's what the true Jubilee is. Setting us free from all that was done and we did to ourselves, and allowing us the freedom to then follow him and be with our God in his bounty and his plenty forever. Don't go back nailing yourself to the doorposts when so much has been done for you already. What a sad, sad situation for this land. Amen.